We get this hour underway on your Friday afternoon by welcoming to the program a best-selling author of books, including The Life and Times of Mickey Rooney, Dr. Feelgood, Beyond Columbo, and his brand new book, which is an absolutely terrific read, Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. We're pleased to welcome to the program author Richard Lertzman. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Rich. I appreciate the invitation.
And timing is quite apropos because tomorrow would be the 105th birthday of the chairman of the board.
Yeah, Mr. Sinatra becomes his 105th birthday, born in 1915.
Well, the book is remarkable. What made you decide to look at the Rat Pack through the lens of Joey Bishop?
Well, I had got to know Joey for about 20 years, and I'd visit his home outside of Newport Beach in Lido Isle, and he had a shrine to the Rat Pack, and he would tell me the inside stories and all about the Rat Pack. And along the way, also, I had known certain people who talked like this, who came from the East Coast in the area I came from, Cleveland, and they had gone to Las Vegas and built up a lot of Vegas. And I got to know guys like Mo Dalitz and Maxie Diamond and Carl Cohn, and they had built places like the Sands and the El Rancho, the Desert Inn, and they told me the blueprint behind the Rat Pack. So I thought of a great concept was to mix Joey's knowledge of the Rat Pack and the real truth of the Rat Pack rather than the legend and put it all together.
Although late in his life, Joey was not all that thrilled about talking to you about the Rat Pack.
Joey resented. He was bitter that everything about his life came down to the Rat Pack because he said, I had a situation comedy, I had a talk show, and, it's not all Rat Pack. But, you know, the truth is, the height of his career is right in the middle of that Rat Pack and that 28 Days and Ocean's 11. So, you know, that's what he's really remembered for.
I love what Sheldon Leonard told you, his reaction when you explained to him that you were basing a book around the experiences of Joey Bishop.
Yes, Sheldon was a tough guy in movies, but he was this great producer. He produced The Andy Griffith Show and Dick Van Dyke and Danny Thomas and I Spy, and I said, I'd like to meet Frank Sinatra. He goes, no way, because he had appeared with Frank in Guys and Dolls, was an old friend of his. I said, how about Joey Bishop? He goes, why would you want to see that Meshuggah, who's like a kind of crazy guy in Yiddish? And he had so many problems with Joey as a producer. He produced the Joey Bishop TV show with Abby Dalton was in it, and Joe Besser from the Three Stooges, and Joey just caused so much, burned so many bridges and so many problems. And guys like Gary Marshall, who did Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and directed Pretty Woman, cut his teeth in that show. And he told me all the problems that happened in that show.
So how did Joseph Gottlieb of Philadelphia become Joey Bishop? And as you say, a guy with ordinary skills become, as he called himself, the glue that held the Rat Pack together.
He became the Bishop Brothers early on with some friends of his, and then he worked a lot of out of mob clubs starting in the late 30s, and he worked all over the country, worked hard, and he was a journeyman comic. He wasn't Jack Benny, he wasn't George Burns, he was, you know, he had a certain skill set, which was he was a great opening act for people, and eventually he got lucky, and he got put as the opening act for Frank Sinatra in the 50s. And what better place to showcase yourself is to open for Frank Sinatra. So for about 8-10 years, he was opening for Frank. And when Frank put together the Rat Pack, his friend, Joey fell right into it. And that really just set Joey off into his own situation comedy, his own talk show. And it set him off for 10 years, you know, just being associated with that.
And as you explain in the book, Rick, the Rat Pack was in many ways a marketing concept.
It was, you know, we think of today of boy bands, and really it is the first boy band because a guy named Al Freeman, who was the publicist at the Sands Hotel, and the guys who owned it, the mob guys, had invested tons of money into these big palaces, the Flamingo and the Desert Inn and the Sands and the Aladdin and all these places, and they really were only drawing people from Los Angeles. And they wanted a plan to put Las Vegas on the map. And so far, the people who had appeared there were Jimmy Durante and Xavier Cugat, Sophie Tucker. And they gave Frank Sinatra 9% of the Sands Hotel. That was Bo Dallas and the Mob Guys. And when Frank was there, they told Frank that they thought that they wanted to have a super event. And Frank had just been working with Dean Martin in Some Come Running, in a film, and he really wanted to work with him on stage. And Davis Jr. had just been in an accident and lost his eye and was just learning how to dance again and do everything again. So Frank wanted to work with them, so he said, let me put Frank and Dean together. He had seen this loose act with Louis Prima and his wife Keeley Smith and Sam Butera in the lounge at the Sahara, and he really wanted to do a loose act. So as they set that up, they set up a 28-day event in Las Vegas. Meanwhile, Peter Lawford, who had just married Patricia Kennedy, was trying to shop this script called Ocean's 11 around town with Peter as a star. He took it to Frank. Frank loved it, took it to Jack Warner. And Frank came with the idea. He said, why don't we shoot it at the Sands? Since he owned 9%, he knew it would be a big seller for the hotel he owned part of. And Warner was thrilled because it was free to shoot there. So they set up 28 days in February of 1960, 60 years ago, 28 days in Las Vegas of an 8 o'clock show and a midnight show. Tickets were $7.
Wow.
but they were sold out like crazy. So they did an 8 o'clock show, a 12 o'clock show, went out into the casino and messed around with customers and went to the lounge shows. And then, well, had to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning for hair and makeup, and they did a movie all day. They shot Ocean's 11. And the world converged on this. I mean, it became, everybody wanted to be seen and heard in Las Vegas. So everybody now from New York and Chicago and St. Louis and Cleveland and Miami, they all converged on Las Vegas, along with all the news media. And it became this, like, the Woodstock of its era. It was, you know, it was Frank, Dean, and Sammy, and Joey, and Peter Lawford.
And is it safe to say that the Sands itself is an integral character in this story?
The Sands is, because it's the Copa Room, and another mobster who used to run the Copacabana in Los Angeles, New York, Jack and Trotter, ran it. And the Sands had 250 rooms. When they announced this event, they had 35,000 reservations the first day. So all the guys who owned all the hotels, all the mob guys, were thrilled to death because it got spread out to all the hotels. And when they made Ocean's 11, they made sure they didn't step on any toes. They included all the hotels, so no one was left out.
We're talking with Richard Lertzman. His book is Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. I thought it was interesting to learn from your book that one of the reasons the Rat Pack and when other groups that preceded it existed is because Frank Sinatra didn't like being alone.
Yeah, Frank was a pack animal. So early on, Frank was friends with Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall and David Niven and this group. They called them the Homely Hills Rat Pack because Lauren Bacall said, you look like a pack of rats. So the newspaper, James Bacon, stuck the name on the Rat Pack to them. So when they came around to do this show, Frank didn't like it, but they called them, the press again called them the Rat Pack because, you know, these are his buddies, his friends. Now, while these guys are now in their mid-40s, Frank was 45 years old in 1960. So, you know, here he is, he's 45 years old, and they're middle-aged, and this is a big payday to them. So while the legends are that these guys are out carousing and partying all night, fact is, Jeannie Martin was with Dean Martin. Patricia Kennedy's with Peter Lawford, and Sammy's with Mae Britt, and Joey's with Sylvia. And these were guys who were very disciplined. Dina Martin told me that whenever her dad was on stage, that drink was actually apple juice.
Well, another myth, too, that you reveal in the book is that they really weren't all that close friends.
Yeah, Frank's friends were guys like Jimmy Van Heusen, and he had another guy named Jilly Rizzo, and he had these guys that hung around him. And they were as professional. I mean, these guys were professional friends. I mean, Frank liked Dean. He loved Sammy Davis Jr. But, you know, these guys had big separate careers. And it's like, you know, the big three of entertainment at that period, you know, merged together. And the thing is, these guys knew that since they're in their mid-40s, their window of fame was kind of, as megastars were kind of fading, because Elvis was right on their tails. And then right around the corner are the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. So pop, and Frank was aware that pop tastes change. So this was their big crowning moment, and was a way for them all to cash in.
Joseph Kennedy saw this as an opportunity as well.
Yeah, Joe Kennedy, you know, who was one of the most brilliant minds in PR. He was a bootlegger before he went to the court of St. James, was an ambassador to England. And so he knew these mob guys. So he didn't want his son to look like Richard Nixon. I mean, John Kennedy and Richard Nixon were almost the same age. But, you know, Nixon looked stodgy and old, and he wanted Kennedy to look like he's young and invigorated and from a young generation, and he's hip. So he told his son-in-law, take Jack with you and bring him down and showcase him in the middle of that Rat Pack. And they started nicknaming it the Jack Pack, because from the stage for 3 days, there's John Kennedy and Frank saying, this is the next president. And they really played him up, and he got all this exposure. And Frank got really into it because he wanted to be a president maker. I mean, he had done almost everything in the business, but this is a way for him to be a part of making a president. And so he was there with the rest of the Rat Pack at the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles in June of 1960. He was the one who ran the inauguration. Dean didn't care about politics. In fact, Dean didn't even show up at the inauguration. And Sammy was kind of blocked at the inauguration because of his affair with May Britt.
Yeah, and in some ways, the election of Kennedy and the situation with Sammy and then with Peter Lawford really drove a wedge and maybe helped speed up the end of the Rat Pack, as they all sort of drifted their separate ways for the most part after that.
Yeah, Frank really wanted the president to fly to his house in Palm Springs. And this would be a crowning achievement for him. And he was planning to fly out, and Frank was building a heliport and built all the convention rooms and everything at his house in Palm Springs. And then he was involved with Sam Giancana at the Calneva Lodge, and Joe Kennedy was really upset. He didn't want his son to be seen with Frank getting all this publicity about working with the mob. So he laid it upon his son-in-law, Peter Lawford, to give him the good news that the president wasn't coming to Frank's house, but he was going to Bing Crosby's house, and Bing was a Republican, which made it even worse. So Frank, you know, said, the next sound you hear, and he hung up the phone on Peter, and Peter was out. Joey bit the hand that fed him. Frank asked him a favor to fill out the Calneva Lodge, and Joey gave him all these demands, and Joey was out. And then in 63, when the president was assassinated, that took the whole air out of the sails of this, because it was the Jack Pack and it was associated with Kennedy, and that kind of spelled the end for the Rat Pack.
Now, Joey Bishop was the last man standing from the Rat Pack, and then after he passed, as you reveal in the final chapter of the book, we learn some secrets about his personal life.
Yeah, you know, I had met Joey for over 20 years, and he had a wife of longstanding, Sylvia, and what I didn't know was that this young girl who worked for Joey was also Joey's mistress, and she ended up with Joey had a nice estate, even though he didn't work pretty much the last 40 years of his life. He had a great business manager, and shockingly, all the money was left to his mistress Dora, and I think the estate is still in dispute almost 13 years later.
How do you explain the continued appeal of the Rat Pack? You write in the book about the miniseries that was based on them, and people still look back at that time, and it was a brief moment in time, but with great affection.
You know, Rich, it's amazing. It resonates 60 years later. And There are Rat Pack tribute groups. A friend of mine, Sandy Hackett, who's Buddy Hackett's son, does a Rat Pack tribute group. There's one that's at Mandalay Bay that's when before Vegas shut down, they were sold out. And people love the music of Sinatra and of Sammy Davis. They love Dean and Sammy. And when you saw them on stage, they were like electric. I mean, they were just so amazing. And it still resonates to this day because probably because of the music and probably because of that swagger and that the last of this misogynistic era that the Rat Pack represented. And when you watch Ocean's 11, you hear Chicky Poo and have a little ring-a-ding-ding. And you watch it with in a perspective from 2020 and you go, you're not going to get away with that today. You know, it's a different era.
Well, if you think you know the Rat Pack, you need to read Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. It is a terrific ride through a fascinating time in American cultural history. Richard Lertzman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, Rich, I appreciate it. Thank you, and happy holidays to you.
Thank you. You too.